5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The Hazard NJ podcast, produced by NJ Spotlight News, is back for a new season, taking a dive into the toxic world of PFAS, a family of thousands of substances often called forever chemicals because they are so long-lasting. It's their durability that makes them useful for all sorts of products and that makes them a threat to our health. Listen and follow Hazard NJ wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People, and welcome to 2025. We are pumped to be back. And this year, has started off with a lot going on. As you know, we talk about all the news that is underreported with regard to race, justice, culture, and equity. And make sure that you follow our Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go.
Family, happy new year. It's 2025. We're back. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Malzi Johnson. You can find me on Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
And this is DeRay at DIY on Twitter.
Well, we're off to... Yeah, I'm just going to need these years to settle on down. I feel like it is January 6th. So obviously much to talk about of the 4-year anniversary of the insurrection of January 6th. Donald Trump will be inaugurated on January 20th. And one of the first things he says that he wants to do is pardon all the January Sixers. I think he calls them hostages now, actually. The folks that are in D.C. jail, and that it was a day of love and that he wants to get all these folks out. Anywho, so that's a thing. I think something very near and dear and so profoundly tragic was what happened on New Year's Eve in New Orleans, a place where you all know I spend a lot of time and have a lot of love for. And I mean, I'm sure everyone has seen sort of the details of this story, but what we're left with is sort of the how we got here and why. I believe 10 people died, including a young man who was a football player at Princeton that played with my brother-in-law. So it really, It's wild, absolutely wild. So that happened. And then, you know, a host of other things, but I mean, those are certainly top of mind for me this morning. How are you all doing, first of all? Happy, we're over the holidays. Is it still Kwanzaa? Mm-hmm. I hope so. January 6th, New Orleans. Oh, and then there with New Orleans, they're also, and they're trying to figure out if they're connected, but the explosion of the cyber truck. And it was at a Trump Hotel.
Trump Casino in Vegas. I don't know how connected they are, but I was just telling y'all offline and I want to mention it. Her name is the knitting cult lady. And she is fascinating. And she was in a cult in her younger age. And then she went on to go into the United States military, which she calls another type of cult. And she makes some fascinating arguments about how, A, some of the institutions that we are used to are already very cult-like, but we're just used to them. So we don't see them for the cults that they are, and that also these institutions prime the mind and the spirit to be able to do some of the things we're seeing being done. So you don't just become okay with dying for something or killing for the sake of something, like your nation, like that, whatever neural pathways that are open to make one be able to conceive of that, they don't just close off, you know, that is something that is always able to be manipulated and to be reasoned with, to be able to do whatever you think is right. So it is interesting to see that a lot of these cases have people in the military, you know, a lot of these people have military background. And I think, again, I just think that everybody should listen to her and start asking some tougher questions about the culture that we live in, because, you know, I hate to say it because it is January 6th anniversary. I'm like, this ain't even the, this is obviously just the beginning.
I think I'm interested, you know, so much of what drives people to vote or not vote or think about politics or not think about politics, or it's certainly what consumes the news, is violence in communities. It is like the ever-present thing. Somebody, it's like these never-ending stories of some sort of violence happening in communities. And I have been so interested about that at the beginning of the year, because the way the media covers like the violence that happens around the state is just so different. And what strikes me about New Orleans is ex-military. What strikes me about Vegas is ex-military. And, you know, you saw people talking about the amount of crimes that happened on these military bases that got swept under the rug. Like, a reporter reported something about Fort Bragg, and it was just like voluminous amounts of just crimes and assaults and those sort of things that he wanted to write about. And he was like, well, nobody would pick it up. And it is not lost on me that in the first attacks of the year, these are people trained by the United States government. And this conversation about the violence that the state supports and trains and inculcates, I think is actually really a big deal. So that struck me. And New Orleans is a reminder of the like importance of just being able to run a city. And this is no knock to the mayor. I like the mayor. But when I learned that there were barricades to stop somebody from driving down the street, but they were removed from maintenance and nobody replaced them with anything, is just a failure of the bureaucracy. It just is. And that is, you know, I'm sure she didn't personally say that, but there are a million, you know, I think about all the cities we've been in where there are cinder block things, you know, there are a lot of ways to block it, but somebody knew that this could happen, which is why they had those metal rods that come up to stop you. And the sidewalk, I don't know if you've ever seen the sidewalk things that they put up that like stop people, but they were renovating and just didn't put anything. And you're like, this is why the government matters. It's like these small things that people don't pay attention to, that all it takes is one day for it to be gone. And I don't know if you saw, but the guy who did the New Orleans stuff, they have all his Ray-Ban. He like had scoped out the scene and like with his Ray-Ban Meta glasses, they have all his videos. And that is just, it was a wild way to start the new year.
Yeah, I think hindsight is probably always like 2020. I think there's probably so many practical things we can think about that could have made everything better or tried to make things better. But I just think the matter of the fact is that he was going to do that. And I think the more disturbing thing, like he would have walked, like even when they went to his apartment, all the bomb, the just the IDs. Things that he had. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just everything that he had. He was just going to do that. And I think the thing that I'm most paranoid about, and I'm sure everybody else is that if there's one person thinking about doing that, then there's a lot more people thinking about doing that. And the permissions that certain presidents and certain leadership give to the culture to participate in certain things. So having people exonerated, I don't know what to call it, to have people not like have to go to jail for January 6th as these things are happening. I don't know. I just see it as like a permission slip. Do y'all feel that way at all?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do. I just think this underlying issue of mental health and wellness is just becoming more and more central to our, like every aspect of American life, particularly when it comes to politics. And, you know, I am I have a military family, and my uncle's been deployed, I think, 6 times over his career to either Iraq or Afghanistan. I have a cousin who also is currently, you know, getting ready to deploy. It's pretty wild what we ask of people to do. And then they come home and there's no support system or structure whatsoever. And so, Miles, I'm really interested in listening to that woman's podcast, just sort of tying these pieces together. And I think, yes, like I think, Miles, to your point, I think there's sort of like a loosening of our rule of law in this country. And I think that loosening is most susceptible to people who are the most vulnerable. And I consider those folks to be people who are struggling with their mental health. And then on top of that, it's just hard as a mofo out there for folks right now. It just is. Things are more expensive than they ever been. We have our biggest income gap between, you know, the rich and the poor at this point. Where is the middle class? I have no idea. So it's just sort of all of these conditions that are just ripening and making us susceptible to people acting out, and the most hurt of those people acting out.
Yeah, that is wild. Oh, I wanted to ask, did y'all see Coco? Switching topics. Coco Gauff?
No, I didn't even know tennis was happening. What was she?
Yeah, no. She was killing it. Lord, she played on it's called the United Cup. It's the one where the team plays. Four of them represent the United States, the United Cup. And Coco, you know, it's a team, but Coco was killing it. So if y'all go look at the highlights, Coco swept the floor. The girl wouldn't even like shake her hand right. But Coco is a class act. And, you know, Naomi had to pull out the last thing she was in because she has like some back issues, which made me sad. But that is a small tennis highlight from our wonderful Coco and Naomi.
Shout out to tennis. Shout out to the girls who sweat.
Oh, goodness. I don't know. Did anything else happen this this go round? I know we're talking about Luther, which I'm excited about.
I think I am excited about having 2 Black women in the Senate. So that they got confirmed over the last couple weeks, which is exciting.
Mike Johnson, too.
Oh, God.
Mike Johnson, yeah.
Did y'all see that sister from the U.S. Virgin Islands that stood up and said, why weren't U.S. Virgin Islands, D.C., Puerto Rico called in for the vote? That was pretty amazing. Did you see that, Miles?
I didn't see it. I don't like these rhetorical questions. Was this a Negro asking this question? We know why. We know what Puerto Rico knows why. We know. We are tired of these rhetorical questions. They are electing Ku Klux Klan members. Why are they not? I wonder why they're not doing this. Because your black ass shouldn't be in the voting ballot. In the ballot, they don't want us.
Because we're colonies.
I'm so disillusioned with these kind of like.
I like it though. Because I just feel like we have to be there. And also, to the young folks, as we, you know, no shade to the young folks. It's not their fault. But since I know in New York City, they're not requiring kids to read books. You know, yeah. It's good to have this imagery around so folks can be like, oh, just let me gives me something to think about.
But I think my big thing with those kind of comments is that we've thought about it. We've talked about it.
Right.
They've been years and years of these kind of gotchas and I wonder why this don't happen or how come we're not part of this. I'm like, because they have codified your oppression and they don't want you to do it. Now what are we going to do about it? I think we're long past the time where you can gotcha candidates for being racist or xenophobic, that they're okay with it. They're okay with it.
That's right.
I wanted to bring up too, since we're talking about Congress, I don't know if you saw Kay Granger. She is a congresswoman who went missing for 6 months. She did not vote for 6 months and they found her living in a retirement home. She didn't run for reelection, so that is good. But the 6 months prior, she's a Texas Republican. She just was she was missing. And, you know, she was still tweeting. Her team was tweeting stuff on her behalf. She was gone. And the news is reporting that she is in a memory care unit at the retirement home. And then Virginia Fox, another Republican, fell down the stairs. And she's from North Carolina. And she is slipped, fell down the stairs, and 81 years old. I just bring this up because we will have to have a serious conversation about the age of the people running the country. It is really, it's a thing. Even I think about Jerry Conley, who beat AOC, and he just did an interview that was like, I never got to chair a committee. You're like, well, that's not, I don't know if that's the best argument for you to be the chair of the committee over AOC, is that you just never got to do it in all your years in Congress. Like, that feels sort of wild, but I wanted to bring them here to talk about.
I've been thinking about this, and it's like, how do I want to enter 2025? Do I want to mind my business and keep my peace? Or do I just really say what I feel, even though I know there'll be repercussions to that? And I think where I'm leaning, since yesterday I was in the gym and OJ's Backstabbers came on, is that maybe...
That went so left. I was like, what? OJ's who? How do you... You know everybody, Tiara.
Smile in your face.
Backstabbers.
All the time, they're trying to take your place.
Okay.
Maybe I need to let people know. And with that, these folks... there are two articles. So there's one of this woman that's missing, and then there's another one, a congresswoman, Virginia Fox, who fell down the stairs in Congress. She's okay. And then Nancy Pelosi and O'Connell also took a tumble in December down these stairs. I'm obvious, by no means am I ageist. I also conceptually don't understand how you, I can't wait to retire. Somebody said today's your last day working, I would say, thank God. Now I can do more with Campaign Zero. I just don't know why these folks keep on keeping on. And obviously it's like this posture around power. And especially for Nancy Pelosi, who, what good she's done us in the last couple of years, I don't know. So I think part of it, yes, I have a concern about their age. I also have a concern of like, when's the last time any of these people have pumped their own gas or gone to a grocery store or cooked their own meals or, I don't know, do anything that most of us have to do every single day? So I think it's the age, but it's also how long you've been in Congress and how long you've been disconnected from actually how people are living. Because what you get when you're in Congress, and also keep in mind, these folks can get these, where else are they going to work now at this point? Well, I guess if they're not in Congress, they're lobbying. I'm over it, and I don't know what I can do to be more helpful in terms of getting more people into Congress. Maybe that's a first step, but these folks have got to go. I'm sorry. This is it. All of them, Republicans, Democrats, in between. If you've fallen down the stairs every week, either take an elevator or stay at home.
Yeah, it seems right on the money for Republicans. You know, it just doesn't really seem like it matters who's in, you know, who's a part of the Republican team. So I kind of the age argument kind of falls flat for me when it comes to Republicans, because the whole party is built off of like these antiquated thought forms mm-hmm. and ideas. So it doesn't matter if it's somebody who's 21 or 81 saying them that. So in that way, it's who cares. It's more disappointing when it comes to for me, when it comes to the Democratic Party, because there is such new ideas and new energy available. And there is just this weird cult-like allegiance to the pageantry and the ways that things need to happen. And I don't, it's like these like old weird vestiges from like the British or something. Like I'm like who cares? I'm like, who cares you didn't get to do that before? I'm like, this is not kindergarten, and like you were line leader yesterday, so you get to be line leader, or you can't be line leader today. Like, it's not like that. This is American politics, and it should be new. So that's disappointing. But you know, you know, hopefully I don't wish harm on anybody, but, you know, let gravity be our justice. And if you got to take a tumble to leave, take a tumble.
Let gravity be our justice, Miles. Crazy.
It's not, and it's also just like, Miles, to your point, Sheila Jackson Lee, may she rest in peace, was a long-serving member of Congress, a great deal of respect for her, but her daughter is now serving in her seat.
Yeah,
it is almost like a monarchy in some respects.
It's not almost. Like, if you look at how the Clintons, the Bushes, mm-hmm. just how it is, it's almost as though if we aren't relentless about being critical around turning into a monarchy, that we will just kind of turn into one. You know, it's almost as though America is oriented towards fascism and you have to do some actual steering the other way, mm-hmm. because if you just let the ship do what it wants to do, it's gonna find a white sheet and it's gonna tell you that, you know, the Aryan race is superior. That's just the culture we're on. And there was something that you said earlier, Jiara, that reminded me of this and like kind of the tension I always feel specifically with just who I'm friends with, what I see. Mm-hmm. And I always think about in this weird Aquarius moon way, how mm-hmm. we are always having brunch on top of the native graveyard. We're always trying to do something celebratory or do something on top of the violence. Yep. And it seems as though now we're in a place where the violence there's not a tablecloth long or thick enough to put over the violence that we're trying to celebrate on top of. And you can't suppress the stench of what we're operating and living on top of. And to me, politics is just one of those symptoms. I guess we'll go into brighter and happier news, which is my news, which is to let you know that homelessness is on the rise and on the expansion. That's right. Oh. Back like cook crack is homelessness.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, 2024 is gone. The question is, what do you want the story of your 2025 to be? Now, every January is a chance to start fresh, to think about new commitments to yourself, to the world, to your work, to the people in your life. When I went through the process for this year, I'm happy that I didn't go through it alone, that my therapist was actually a partner with me. And I think about therapists as an editorial partner of sorts, helping me to think about what the story is I want to write for the new year. And I want to make sure this year that my resolutions don't fade by February, for instance. I'm also trying to be a little more intentional. And one of the best things about therapy for me is talking to somebody who is not in my day-to-day life and also hearing myself process the world week in and week out. Now, BetterHelp is a great way to get a therapist. BetterHelp is fully online, making therapy affordable and convenient, serving over 5 million people worldwide. And you have access to a network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists, wide range of specialties, diverse pool of people, and you can easily switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. Write your story with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people.
So, in all seriousness, I wanted to bring this story, and I've seen this story in different iterations. I wanted to bring this up because what I thought was the most interesting, because people were talking about the economy late last year, was that so many people inside of certain bubbles were talking about how great the economy was. And this article, in the article that I found around the rising of homelessness, shows that a lot of these people who are experiencing homelessness now are fully employed people. Right. There are people who have multiple jobs. There are people who have cars. There are people who are going to their good jobs and their coworkers don't know. And there are people who are at these jobs with other coworkers sharing tips about how to survive and be homeless. I went on a rabbit hole on YouTube because I am at odds with my mental health. And there are loads of videos with people giving other people advice on how to be homeless. And they're not people who is whatever your stereotype of what homelessness looks like. These are average, everyday, working people who look like me with button-ups and sweaters over their button-ups, looking preppy like me. If you can't see me, it's a shame. But that's the people who are telling other people how to be homeless and how telling people how to survive these things. And that feels different. And it also feels embarrassing to not embarrassing to me personally, but it should be embarrassing to us as Americans that there are people who are doing this. It's laughable of us trying to kind of announce our national or global authority and leadership, and we have people who are living third world realities in our very country. You know, I feel like we forget about that. The other component of this is that the median rent price is just rising. So you have people who are in New York, and I don't know if I said this before on this podcast, but I'll kind of repeat it shortly again. You have people who are maybe living somewhere in the Bronx, right? And you lived in the Bronx and you were in the Bronx when your apartment is just for an even number, $1,000. And now, 10 years later, however many years later, it's incrementally gotten up to $2,500, which you cannot afford because the price of your income has not shifted like that. Now you're kind of gridlocked from moving, right? Because in order to move, that's going to cost you $10,000 that you absolutely do not have. But in order to stay, it's costing you everything. And it kind of keeps people in these prisons where they have to wait for evictions. They have to wait for some kind of like financial calamity to happen to get freedom. And once that freedom from that particular housing happens, it's not like we have a comprehensive place for you to fall. You fall on the streets, and more people are falling on the streets. I wanted to bring this to the podcast because just for obvious reasons, but also because of this Martin Luther King quote. I was reading a lot of Martin Luther King towards the last year of Barack Obama's presidency, and I was asked to write about Barack Obama and hope and all this other bullshit that he was saying. And I've felt that language and that kind of like millennial core 2000s language was so dead and empty. And I never understood why. And it was in King's words who, if I'm being honest with you, I found King's words dead and empty, the ones that were in commercials. But the more I was reading him, the more I was kind of illuminated where I was like, oh, I don't know the actual Dr. King. I don't really know his words, but I wanted to share these quotes. This is from the Drum Major Instinct on his sermon called The Drum Major Instinct on February 4th, 1968. He stated, if America does not use her vast resources of wealth to end poverty and make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life, she too will go to hell. King also said in Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, which was delivered on April 4th, 1967, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. So these things were said in 1967 and 1968. Like I said in that essay, and like I'll say now, I think the real project is to contend with that we're dealing, when we're talking about America, we're dealing inside of a dead thing. We're dealing inside of a culture of death. We're dealing inside of a culture that is rotting. And these are the symptoms of living in something that's rotting. But it feels as though certain people are still trying to make gardens on a corpse because they're in denial. And there's other people who are like, no, we need to totally let this thing go because I can't breathe. I can't do this. I can't live inside of this. And that is speaking of what we're facing in 2025 and the reality that we're facing, and it being January 6th anniversary, it just feels like that is the truth to recognize, is that, you know, The Walking Dead is a fiction, But there's something to the idea that the culture of America that we're walking inside of is a zombie culture, is a culture that is feeding off of the mistakes of America's ancestors. I think that is what we're looking at when I look at everything that's happening from the terrorist attacks to the homeless population raising and the exploitation, everything that's going on with the oligarchies and all this other stuff. That is the culture that we are that we're karmically drinking up right now. And I want us to be real about that and not pretending that it's lemongrass soup when it's not.
Yeah, Miles, I think all that is right. And over the holidays, I went to Montgomery, where my aunt and uncle live. My uncle was in the Air Force. The last place he was stationed was at Maxwell Air Force Base. And, you know, big part of my family is from Minnesota. So when it was like, Auntie Reed and Uncle Troy are moving to Alabama, we all were like, what? Alabama? But anyway, 16, 17 years later, we go there all the time, spend lots of time there. And I did a long run downtown and I was like, I'm just going to do the sites, all the historic sites in Montgomery. And I started with where Rosa Parks did not get off the bus and then went to the Baptist Church, Dexter Baptist Church, where Dr. King was a pastor at one point and where they organized a lot of the civil rights activity down there. But the thing that I was sort of most impacted by, right? It's because there's been so much work, particularly by Brian Stevenson and EJI, to demarcate the truth of American history, right? So there's EJI, and if y'all have not been to Montgomery, you have to go because now the Legacy Museum is an expanded space. It's even bigger and more compelling and more drop you to your knees. And then there's also the Freedom Sculpture Park, which is a sculpture park that is incredible. So Simone Lee, Hank Willis Thomas, Wangechi Mutu, like all these folks have massive scaled sculptures in this park. And then there are also these replicas of cabins where enslaved people would have lived their lives. But it's all very compelling, right? So you have all of this, and there's also a great deal of sort of reverence and storytelling around indigenous people who were first there in Alabama, obviously, and then forced to leave, Trail of Tears, all these things. And then that's when it started, that's when the cotton production started. And then Montgomery became sort of the hub of the selling of African bodies, like the hub, like a train was brought in, boom, they're right there. And all of this is there. In Montgomery, right? Like it is all there for you to see and feel. But the overlay of that is the placards that exist that the white folks done put around town, right? So it tells this sort of mystical fairy tale version of what happened in Montgomery, Alabama, from the founding of the city. To it to cotton production starting, to these early settlers, I forget what the exact language was about how they got all the acres from indigenous people, but it was, you know, but it's very like this transition happened. And Miles, I think to your point, like there is this very live tension happening in America where it is. There's the truth of what happens, and then there's what others want us to believe is happening. And that's what we see around banning books and CRT and all these other things. And it's a real tension. I say all of that to sort of lay the groundwork. I was on a plane going somewhere, and I sat next to the loveliest white man, and he was with his daughter. And we talked the whole time. I think I was going to Houston. I was going to Houston because I also saw Hot Boys Holiday over the break.
Okay.
And that was spectacular.
Okay.
So, but his perspective was somehow we start talking about schools and where his daughter was at school, where I had gone to school in DC, and how he said in a way, and in a very earnest way, if we keep teaching this history, we're going to continue to be divided. And I was like, wow. Like this lovely, regular, schmegular white man on the plane I'm with, like actually believes that a reckoning wouldn't make us better. It would drive us further apart. But Miles, to your point, I think that, and I think that's very much the sentiment.
Okay, wait, let me follow. Because yes. I'm sure if I'm confused, maybe the listeners might be confused. But just to be clear, this is a lovely white man, Mr. Rogers. You would never expect anything. He would have voted for Obama 3 times if he could.
He did.
So he would have voted for Obama 3 times if he could. But when it comes to the teaching of American history, Black American history, or critical race theory is what some people want to, whatever that means, that he doesn't believe in the teaching of that. Got it. Yeah, but that is white people. That's whiteness. Whiteness is this surrendering into this great big nothing. That's what Irish people have done. That is what Italian people have done. That is what many Jewish people have done. It is about surrendering whatever makes you identifiable and trading it in for a house, a mid-century house, 2.5 kids, and a dog, and a fence. That's what whiteness is. And Black people who want to do that get privileged. And black people who fight against that get demonized. That is what it's all about. And you can't have that and still remember history. You can't have that and still remember what's happening. So there is this kind of desire for a cultural dementia from white people and whiteness, because that means you don't have to talk about what you did 60 years ago because we don't even remember it. But my mom does because she was born in 1960. You know, my grandmother does because she was born in 1940. Like that is just the fact of it. But it makes sense that somebody can still be an extremely pleasant, great person to interact with and talk to, but they've been taught to be white. And we've all been taught to be white. It's a mm-hmm. miracle that there's anybody mm-hmm. on this mm-hmm. in this nation who thinks otherwise, because we're all taught to leave in the past, don't talk about it, oh my goodness, you know, stop bringing up old stuff, we have to move beyond, be together. And it's like, no, we can't move beyond, because the past is literally sitting down and eating breakfast with us and blowing up cyber trucks in front of stuff. The past is here and talking and shooting.
Did you not see, you know, I wasn't going to bring this up and was going to potentially propose this for next week, but David Frum in Atlantic, he wrote an article that just came out yesterday on the 5th that is called Against Guilty History. And he makes this argument that you are saying, DR, that like one of the lines literally is like, no country has a like a clean past. And this idea of rehashing it over and over just isn't very helpful. That's sort of like what his thing is. So he said, settler colonial is not intended purely or even primarily as a description of a particular path of social development. It is intended as a condemnation of the new societies that have been created by that path of development. And there's something very peculiar about this critique of Canada and elsewhere in the New World. Moral critique is always based on an implied moral alternative. He goes on, but I was like, oh, this is in the Atlantic. This idea that like settler colonial is saying that is a bad thing, or having some moral sense that like we probably shouldn't have colonized all these countries. And later he makes the argument that like at some point somebody was going to discover the New World, like it was inevitable. And you're like, well, that is really, really,
but it's like you're doing all of that analysis to avoid the truth of the matter. It's just, I think, Miles, to your point, like that is the whiteness whiting, because it's just like, just come to terms with it.
That's the big thing about
move, and then we can move on from it. But just the aggressiveness to which we're seeing people push back on the truth of the matter. And luckily, we have someone like a Brian Stevenson who actually has been doing the deep work of understanding how many Black people were lynched, how many Black people actually arrived here. Also, there's so many stories at EJI just of like stories from enslaved people, and people once they were free trying to find their families. Like, we don't even have an accounting of what has happened to our people. So it's not only do you not want us to understand what we know, you don't want us to continue to try to understand what more can be told about the possibility of this place, which is what I thought this place was all about.
And that's what happens with this whole thing. It's a whole big flattening of the past, you know, whereas like the terrorism that happened during in the Deep South in the 1900s is separate from it's connected to, but separate from chattel slavery, which is separate from the discovering of this. But if it's everything's just the past, so everything that has happened prior to the year 2001 didn't happen, then it just looks like all of this is just one big glob, and that is what happens too. And then the other thing that story, or DeRay's summarizing of the story, made me think of too, is how sometimes because we're on the internet and we're passing around so many text and language, we think that the language is the primary point, where the language, the reason why we are, the point of reminding somebody that we're in a settler colonial state, the point of reminding people about racism, is because we're trying to let the public cultural know that something happened wrong and there's debts owed. Those things are not just being talked about just because they're fun to discuss. It's because we're trying to get reparations. It's because we're trying to get Indigenous people to have adequate housing. We're trying to connect the wrongs that we're experiencing today to historical wrongs. So that's why we're doing it. We're not just doing it just because we love a label. we're trying to show people right and wrong and get us to do the right thing in the present to correct our past wrong so we can manifest a better future. Do people not know that, or are people not knowing that on purpose? Because once you get to the Atlantic, I'm prone to think that you don't know it on purpose.
They don't care. And another thing, we got to go to Montgomery. Another thing that EJI has set up there is you can click on a state, go search last names, and find your relatives. You know, white people, how y'all have Ellis Island? We don't have that. We don't have it. Now we sort of do. And just like understanding what that does for your identity. And it's miraculous. And so I think, Miles, yes, it's to tracing and being able to point to this is happening because of this, but also from a very like spiritual, emotional, self-preservation perspective, it is for Black folks to have a place to go to say, oh, I am standing here because so-and-so. But anyway.
I want to read the DR. You brought this up. I do have something to say about homelessness, but since you brought up Montgomery, I'm like, here we are. I'm going to read the way that David ends it, because it directly ties to what both of you have been saying. He ends it by saying, there are passages of guilt to remember and expiate. History should always be told in full, but we don't correct past wrongs committed in a liberal democracy by defaming the ideal itself. Like Americans, Australians, and New Zealanders, modern-day Canadians live in a good and just society. They owe honor to those who built and secured that good and just society for posterity, to the soldiers and sailors and airmen who fought the wars that kept those societies free, to the navies and laborers who built their roads, laid their rail, dug their seaways, to the authors of their laws and the framers of their constitutions, and yes, to the settlers and colonialists and colonists who set everything in motion. In the Atlantic.
Also, who you think built the roads over there, David? talking about?
That's why it's so hard to even engage with this as an actual, because what this sounds like is somebody who has white supremacist ideals, who has these racist ideals, who has got sophisticated enough to wrap this kind of this imperialist white supremacist reframing of America and did such a good job that it's landed into the Atlantic. So when you're able to, and that goes both ways, you know, when you read certain things by bell hooks, you're like, oh, bell hooks really went there, but she knew how to wrap her language. Now, of course, that's something that I find righteous and good. But it, the same thing can happen when it comes to white supremacy and evil. Like, you can learn how to wrap your language around saying, we want everybody in America who's an American to believe in this story. And just like you could look at your grandpa and still have Thanksgiving dinner with him, we want you to look at George Washington like that or Christopher Columbus like that. That is what the request is. And most people are saying, no, I don't want to do that. And it's obvious. Even the comparisons, it doesn't even make any sense. There's obviously something wrong with America. Look at, things are blowing up. Things are getting shot. People are homeless. Like, it's obvious that the culture in America is not good. So we need to excavate the guilty and dark stuff, because if we were living in this kind of utopia and the only thing we had to care about is freaking kangaroos and big spiders, we would be different, you know? And not to mention there's a whole indigenous population of Australia who is silenced. That's how come you don't hear any critical things about Australia, because the whole indigenous population is silence of what we're seeing. That's what Israel does too, right? Like we're seeing a pattern, and America is unique in the fact that the people who are the most exploited are not the most silenced, or we have figured out ways to not make ourselves the most silenced through culture, through you know, we know Black American history.
That's right. I just was gonna say that I think part of it also, Miles, is that he also has to defend a meritocracy where his mediocre perspectives and writing can actually give him his livelihood, right? So I think that's the other thing that they're holding on to, is that, like, they want this seemingly meritocracy where they're, you know, we do all the things and we work with, where they want that system to continue. Because otherwise you have peoples who have been living through genocide, chattel slavery, Jim Crow, et cetera, who have somehow figured out how to thrive and be better than you. That's what you're really scared of. We're coming.
So to Montgomery, you know, I went to during the protest Tiara, and one of the most interesting facts I think about Montgomery, Miles, have you been?
To Montgomery, Alabama?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. I'm from
so, you know, that Dexter Church is very close to the Capitol, and they say that that is the only reason why I was not blown up, is that to blow it up would necessarily mean that you probably blow up some of the Capitol and the Supreme Court, which is also on that street. So they talk about that as, like, sort of the unintended insurance policy with that church, that, like, it kept it safe during the craziest parts of the civil rights movement, just because it happened to be so close. And I asked them, why was it built there? And they were like, because back then, Black and white people couldn't go to the same church. So diagonally across the street from Dexter is a white church. So that's where the white people go. They would drop their slaves off, or, like, and then they would go to church right there. So, And then, DR, did you go to the White House of the Confederacy, which is behind the Capitol?
I refuse.
Went in, the centerpieces are cotton. That was crazy. And then there's a picture book about Jefferson Davis's family, and there's a little Black boy in it. And I'm like, I'm asking a tour guide, like, who's this little Black boy in the family? It's a picture book about the family. And they're like, oh, that's their adopted son. They adopted a Black child. I'm like, y'all, get me out of here. This lion, they did not
burn adopt it down.
Y'all are lying in here.
To the ground. Okay.
It's a mess.
Let's not say nothing like that.
Because I've been going to Montgomery for a while now. When you would come off that highway, that'd be the only sign you see. White House of the Confederacy. Keep in mind, I mean, like, the historical, the Civil Rights Trail that goes through Montgomery, Alabama. There are endless sites. And you know what else is there, too? And we actually reported on it, and I saw it in person, was the Mothers of Gynecology. That's there. That is incredible.
I need to go see that.
Oh, my God. But it's like... It's, we got to go.
Have like pause, save the field trips? Because people
want, do that.
People want third spaces. People want places that are not Starbucks to meet up and to talk and to do things. And I think people are thirsting, but want to be together, but the world is scary. And I think we should do pause, save the field trip for learners of all ages and sizes.
I love it. Here's what I have to say about homelessness. So recently, there's a blog done by Societal Analysis, and the blogger is a researcher there. And he talked about a luncheon he went to at the Columbus Metropolitan Council, a club, and asked how much would it cost to solve homelessness. As you know, there are about a little bit over 600,000 people who are homeless. And the median rent in January 2024 was about a little bit under $1,400. That means that it would cost, it's about 650,000 people are experiencing homelessness, sorry. It would cost around $11 billion to house all those people. Just as a reminder, we have spent over $60 billion in the Ukraine.
It's actually cheap.
I say this because for the cost of incarceration and services and all these things we do that is not providing homelessness, it would be far cheaper if people actually cared about the fiscal policy. But I say this also because the fiscal narrative and the whatever is actually, like, I think the lie that people say in public. I think truly underneath it, people think that people deserve to be homeless. That, like, you made a mistake. You didn't work hard enough. You didn't, like, something, you did something wrong and therefore you're homeless. So to help you would be giving you an unfair advantage, a help out, like a handout. Like, I actually think that that is what's underlying the way people treat the issue of homelessness. So that's, like, I wanted to say that here. Interested in what you have to say. And the second is going back to the bureaucracy problem of homelessness. So in New York City, for instance, the city tracked 1,000 people who applied and got approved for homeless for spots, and tracked, did they actually make it into the spot? Of the 955 people, only 18% ever made it into the spot. There are 4,000 homeless units or units in shelters in New York City that are sitting vacant today because the city has not figured out the matching. Some people died before they got to the housing. Some people never got a call back. They're homeless, so the city hasn't figured out how to find them again after they approve them because they might not have an address. But there is a real bureaucratic issue happening because even in New York City, which famously has a right to shelter law, if you're homeless, you have the right to a room, the city can't actually match the people. And that is just a huge indictment of the like city infrastructure that's supposed to help people. And, you know, Eric Adams is a nightmare. So there's that.
And we see all these damn drones. So if you wanted to go ahead and find somebody, we know that you could. It's just not a, it's just really just not a priority. And what you were saying earlier about homeless people, just like around the, like, people not wanting people to be, to find housing. Like, I do think that's right. And I know I was supposed to wait until next week to maybe talk about this. I just want, but I did want to maybe interject this really quickly about the reason why I wanted to alert people to Merriam-Williamson is because she's talked in multiple platforms so earnestly and just really, really well. Like, there's just no other way to put it. She talked really, really well about these type of things. That was the first politician to say something that I've said before on this podcast, as far as you shouldn't have to be, she said verbatim, well, not necessarily verbatim, but very, very close. You shouldn't have to be talented or work hard or any of these things in order to live well or to have a house or to have food in America. Like, that is that to me was just baffling to hear somebody say. And I saw the comments and the reactions to people her saying that. She talked about how there's blood plasma centers in the poorest of countries coming up, and that's because people can't pay their rent, so they're selling their blood regularly in order to pay rent. Like, all these different things that I just hadn't not heard politicians say. And I'm like, yeah, that's what we're facing. We're not facing stocks. We're not facing, you know, I need $25,000 down for a house, you know. That's a privilege problem. We're really facing, I'm selling my blood for both groceries and to pay my rent. And these, I just want to interject that into the air, because I think that whoever's able to grasp onto those narratives, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is going to really have a lot of power, because that's what people are really dealing with.
And I know we've talked about this for a long time, so I will move on because I know my news is next. But But Miles, to that point, it is really interesting that the right just lies about so much of what happens with the subsidies and helping people out, and that becomes a narrative. So you remember the child tax credit. I don't know if you remember, but one of the biggest reasons the Republicans have had against the child tax credit is that they were like, parents use a child tax credit to buy drugs in 2021. That's why they have like let it lapse and da-da-da. And there is a new study out that shows that people did not use a child tax credit. It just came out on January 3rd that people did not use a child tax credit to buy drugs. And I say this because, A, just think about all the smart people that had to stop whatever they were doing to prove this wrong, which is just ridiculous. And they use these racist narratives to stop substantive change happen for people, and it just becomes a nightmare.
Okay. That makes so much sense. I thought I was responding to you. Sorry.
No, go ahead. You can. And then I'm going to talk about the militia.
Okay. No, that makes so much sense to me. Anytime I hear stories like that, I also think about the data from those elections, though. And I think about how many people who would vote Democrat were who just didn't vote, you know? So I do know that the Republicans lie, and the people who are already oriented to believe their lies are gonna believe it. But I'm very concerned about so many people just totally sitting them out. And this is where Black people are. Most Black people aren't voting for Trump. Most Black people are just not voting. So when that is the circumstance, I'm thinking, well, we don't need to convince those people that that's not happening with the child tax credit because Republicans are lying. We need to be able to convince people who are not voting that you going out and vote actually matters. And it's hard to convince when you're like, yeah, your reality hasn't changed if you're a Black person living in the rural South, or if you're a Black person who is living in living in poverty in certain places. Your reality hasn't changed from Trump to Biden to Obama. So what's the difference? And to me, that's where at least my focus and my ideas like tend to go towards, because the other thing feels so helpless. Because I feel like those people are believing things for reasons that are not just data. It is because they have a underlying desire to believe in to believe that Black people are doing bad things with free government money. That's something that they want to believe. So
So with my news, it's a very comprehensive article by ProPublica about a guy who infiltrated a militia at the highest levels, and then got out and gave all the information to this reporter at ProPublica. There's a lot to read there, so I will do the highlights for me. One is, and he was in Utah. One is that he's like a lot of people involved. Every walk of life, doctors, police officers, you name it. And the common denominator is that they were heavily armed. That is one thing. The second is that what I did not realize is that he was like, the membership of these militia organizations is much more porous than people think. So he's like, they sort of go back and forth through them like square dancing is the analogy that they say in the article. So like AP3 is where the guy starts. He leaves there and goes to the Oath Keepers. And there's like, the common thing they have is like the don't believe in the government and sort of this veil of white supremacy and stuff like that. But the allegiance is not actually to one group. It's to the idea, and that the people sort of switch groups often, which I thought was interesting. And that wasn't what I had anticipated. The role of the police in this is something I did anticipate. And one of the leaders that he works under and eventually even lives with, which I thought was crazy, was a former Las Vegas Metro police officer who had worked for over 23 years in the force and eventually was assigned to the Black Squad in Las Vegas Metro PD. You might wonder, what is the Black Squad? The Black Squad, according to court documents, was tasked with investigating crimes where the suspect was Black. The Las Vegas Metro Police Department has now said they no longer divide the squads by race. I just had to say that out loud because when I read it, I thought that was knuckin' futz. He eventually his career goes on a downturn because on Facebook, he writes that he would, quote, welcome a race war. And he said, bring it, quote, I'm about as fed up as a man, American, Christian, white, heterosexual can get. He then goes to say that, you know, he just had an axe to grind and he was having a bad day. In 2016, he turned in his badge and before it broke. So I thought that was interesting with that guy. The last things I'll say is he turned over a ton of stuff, like Signal chats and all this other stuff. There was a sheriff who was involved that he gets all these members to brag about the law enforcement officers that they have connections to, which is why he goes to reporter and not law enforcement, because he's like, law enforcement is in bed with all of these people, which I thought was interesting. And then at one point, he tells a reporter that there are about 40,000 former members that they have email addresses and contact information for. And at the very end, it ends with this really sophisticated doxing system they have for reporters who are critical of either issues they like or critical of them. So, like, you know, they have this one reporter's whole family. They have information about them, all this stuff. And it's just like a routine part of it. And I thought that was really interesting. My personal connection to this is that I will never forget in Ferguson, the Oath Keepers came. We had never heard of the Oath Keepers. They just sort of showed up. They were white men with guns. And they sort of like suggested that they were on our side. But I remember meeting them and being like, something ain't right with these people. Like, this is sort of weird. And it was actually the first real fight we had with other protesters. Because I remember people being like, because I was critical of them on Twitter. Like, I'm not going to a meeting with them. Da-da. And other protesters were like, Teray, these people are fine. You're just being da-da-da-da. And I remember being like, I'm not rocking with Oath Keepers. And then later we realized these are like white supremacists. And people are like, yeah, those people are crazy. I'm like, yeah, when these white men with guns just popped up in the middle of Ferguson, that feels not real. They are trying to like wreak havoc. And they do talk about, even in the article, it was interesting to see the way the police violence stuff came up, is that one of the turning points for him was Tyree Nichols being killed by the Memphis PD and the protests that ensued even in Utah and like how the white supremacists were planning to infiltrate those protests across the country. Anyway, I brought it here because I was interested in your takes on this expose, the vast network of the militia. And the last thing I'll say about language is that if this was Black people, this would be called a gang. Just the language would be different. We wouldn't say they're heavily armed Black. There would be like gangs across America are planning and da-da-da-da-da. It wouldn't get militia, which sounds just like a little more neutral and less overtly violent to a lot of people. These would be called gangs. And I was interested in how the language of white people organizing violence is just different.
That's interesting that militia hits you as less violent, because it in my ears actually hits me as more violent. I think because of the hip hop culture and because of just like the overuse of gangs, gangs have kind of like not necessarily, gangs and thugs have kind of like lessened their, I don't know, they just feel like empty words to me a little bit sometimes. And militia actually sounds a little scarier to me. And I remember that language being used a lot in when it comes to like Middle East, like things happening in the Middle East and stuff like that. So that's interesting too. The thing that made me the most concerned, or not even concerned, but the thing that just struck me is the synergy. It's always the synergy. It's the fact that this type of radicalism has such a synergy with institutions that we're supposed to be able to trust. And you have to look at why do police officers and these militias, why do they go hand in hand? Why do certain occupations, certain races, certain places of empowerment and disempowerment go so hand in hand with this type of domestic terrorism planning? That to me, that's what this detailed. And yeah, it's a boring old story, but we know how come police officers exist. We know that they were people who looked over slaves, and I think that we're still living in the aftermath of that. And I think that that's how come so much of the white supremacist terrorism and the and these other institutions go so hand in hand. What I am scared about too, which I've always been scared about, is what's going to happen when these militias and stuff like that get a hold of and understand AI and dark web and all these other stuff even deeper. So not just about how to make things, but problem solve certain things. Like, I'm just I think we should have a healthy awareness around that as our technologies evolve, so does evils. So that's what this made me think of too, because if they're already planning to infiltrate and do these different things, then of course they're going to integrate different technologies to help them do those things. And that's how come, I think, name one of y'all Black folks who I'm talking about, DeRay, Diara, anybody who's listening to me, I don't think none of y'all should be telling where your address is. I think that healthy paranoia is good right now, because I think that we're we've been in a weird time, but now we're in even weirder times. I'm trying to say it without being alarmist, but y'all get what I'm putting down.
It's interesting what's happening to my body is in this conversation. Just as someone who has studied and supported movements in my lifetime, and I think, you know, learning about the aggressive and violent dismantling, sort of the try at dismantling of the Black Panther Party, and how there are folks who are still in jail, Kamal Siddiqui, Joseph Bowen, Ashada Shakur still on the FBI most wanted list, so it's George Wright. And also, like, the children of these people, right? So, like, the children of Black revolutionaries who have had to deal with, you know, the violence against their parents, the murder against their parents, the aggressive use of the United States legal system to crush their family members. And then you look at how these militias are treated and how it's just seen as folks trying to protect their Second Amendment rights, and how most of them are actually former law enforcement or former military. I think it speaks to racism in this country in terms of how that impacts how folks are portrayed, media perception, et cetera, et cetera. So this is something that really makes me angry, I guess, is how I'm feeling right now. Because it is to really understand and to hold the continued assault against our people, it's a little overwhelming sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
It really is. And it's like, it's people's lives, you know, it's people's lives in terms of like what systemic oppression and the legacy of chattel slavery have meant in this country. But it's also just like the people who are fighting and protesting and laying their bodies on the line and all of that, like the happenings to them versus the happenings to these other fools, these January 6th rioters, who Donald Trump, I'm sure, will absolve when he gets into office. It just, obviously, it makes all the sense in the sort of enigma that is the United States. But from a heart place, it's a hard thing to make sense of.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. Pod Save the People is brought to you by OneSkin. Now, January is all about fresh starts. And it's a great time to swap out the skincare products that have been weighing your skin down in favor of a regimen that is scientifically proven to transform your skin at the cellular level, something today's sponsor, OneSkin, knows all about. Their products are powered by OS1, a proprietary peptide the four founders, who are all skin longevity scientists, developed after testing 900 other peptides. And it's scientifically proven to switch off the aging, dysfunctional cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. Not only that, OneSkin's products are packed with nourishing ingredients like andiroba oil, brew bronco, and moringa seed extract to naturally boost collagen, reduce inflammation, and protect skin from environmental stressors, while being free of unnecessary irritants like sulfates and fragrance. The OneSkin product that I love is a facial cleanser. It's light, it's easy, it does exactly what you need it to do, not a lot of fuss. I also love the travel size that they have in all the products, because I'll tell you, when I travel, sometimes the skincare stuff goes by the wayside. I can't like figure out the, you know, is it going to get taken by TSA, whatnot. But OneSkin has already figured that out for you, high quality, and they already have the travel sizes. What I love about OneSkin too is that it is a company that's founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists. And they're redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS1 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code PSTP at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code PSTP. After you purchase it, they'll ask you where you heard about them, and please tell them that you heard about them here at Pod Save the People. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you.
Your next year.
Thank God. Thank God, y'all.
Turn this house into a home.
Turn any love. Can we have any love?
It's never too much. It's not-
My news is about Luther Vandross.
Whoop, whoop.
Okay. My mom and I watched the documentary on CNN. And I'm just so happy to be Black. I just don't know. I'm just so exuberant about it. I mean, thank everyone, honestly, that had a part in me being Black in America today. I am so proud of Luther Vandross, like so, so proud of him. And I think I would go so far to say that he is the most talented vocalist to have ever lived on the planet Earth. Okay?
Definitely male vocalist.
I mean, yeah. So, you know, and this, there are things that, like, I didn't really know about Luther. I didn't know that he was, like, straight up from New York City. Like, born, like, started his life on the Lower East Side, went up to the Bronx, grew up between the Bronx and Harlem, like, a New York City kid. And so much that, like, in his singing, in the first group he was in, that I'm forgetting the name, but they were fabulous, he ended, Jim Henson put them on Sesame Street, like early Sesame Street, because they were like New York kids singing about, you know, we're going to make ABCs real cute. Then he ended up singing background for like David Bowie, Bette Midler, like. And then the other thing I didn't know about him is he is like a song, he wrote all the songs. To just name somebody, Aretha, Pat, just all of them. And so there's just this incredible, endless talent that came out of him that we should all be so appreciative of. And then there's the other side of this, which again, we need to come together as a Black family and figure out why we're responsible for killing this man. Because we did, Black people. We did. We did. We did. And there's so many things that were unsaid in this documentary. And it was, it's an interesting, Dawn Porter, who is actually a renowned documentarian. She also worked on Good Trouble. That's maybe where her name is familiar to most folks. But there wasn't a ton on the personal of it. And Luther himself never came out. And what was also interesting, there wasn't very much perspective from his family. Now, the person that came up for me that really had some alarms go off, who I've spoken about before, is that Sissy Houston. So Sissy was very much around, and we know how she felt.
No. I'm Sissy talking to Oprah. No.
No.
I would not have liked it.
No.
I do not like rainbows. I do not like girl on girl, boy on boy, Adam and Eve.
And Dionne Warwick.
Patty didn't sign the waiver, which is why she's not in it.
There's a whole thing with Patty. So then I spiraled last night because I'm like, that's such a short clip of Patty. And there's a beef happening right now because Patty feels like the way she was portrayed in it made her feel sort of like a bully. Like she was the only one to speak about his sexuality. And she had a, evidently cut a bunch to be included in the documentary, but wanted to have a take, a look at what the final was going to be, and wasn't given that privilege. Now, I'll tell you something. Mariah Carey was in this, and you know who I bet you got to see it before it came out? Is the Mariah Carey. I know that 1,000
oh, really?
Percent. 1,000. I know my
girl. But Mariah green light stuff, and I love Mariah. But she's greenlining stuff based off of what side you're showing, not based off of what the content you are the show.
So, but she but thank you, Miles, because that is exactly. She's having that last look. But anyway, so that there is that. But it is, they also showed sort of, you know, like whether it was Eddie Murphy or Cedric the Entertainer talking about Luther's weight over the years and the yo-yoing of the weight. And what I never really put together, first of all, Luther Vandross was 54 years old when he died.
Crazy. I didn't know that until I was like, oh my God, he was young.
54. And he had diabetes. And then the weight yo-yoing, and he had a stroke. And I feel like it's the same. And Black people, you obviously, I just said how much I love being me. But why are we so mean to each other? It's the same thing that happened with Whitney when Whitney, remember when Whitney got really, 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 really thin? And how everybody talked about it like a dog. So I've been listening to Luther nonstop, and I'm just so proud and so overjoyed and so all these things. And like, because when you think of him, you really do think of love. Like you do. Like he just Absolutely. Was a, like, we didn't deserve him. And but the other side of this is like, gosh, we got to be kinder to each other. And I don't know how we can figure out how to do that at scale, but we really, really do. And maybe that is part of us all going to Montgomery as a people.
If this world were mine.
Listen.
No, DeRay has such a raspy.
Wait, no.
I'm done. Y'all sorry.
Let me go before Miles, because Miles is way smarter than me on the culture. So let me get my little two words in before Miles, you say something smart.
I'm just going to compliment your singing voice.
You know, Luther, my cousin. Didn't realize he was that young. The articles, the headlines back then, oh my God, brutal. I'm like, the stuff they printed as just like news article headlines, crazy. It makes me sad that a generation will never know Oprah. Like, I remember being young, being like, I want to do something important enough to get on the Oprah show. But like, you know, he the last interview he ever did was with Oprah. And to see him struggle to speak, I'm like, oh my God, that broke my heart. Like, we not only let this happen to you, but we let you go. Like, you were, they threw you out. You know, like, it was in the transition to hip hop, Luther Vandross did, like, and I forgot that Dance With My Father was so late in his, like, I forgot that was like the swan song, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was interesting to me. I think I also was obviously sad that he wasn't able to come out or like to find love. But even like the little stories, like the fact that his assistant had to break in the house to find him on the floor after having the stroke, I'm like, you're Luther Vandross. You know what I mean? I'm like, we really, what happened? And then, you know, what I loved outside of all of his musical accomplishments and just the ear he had and his, just the gift, you know, so few people can walk on a stage and just sing. He'll need any, the fluff is cool because he appreciates the pageantry and grew up listening to Dion and all those other people. And like, I appreciate the artistry, but if you just gave him a microphone and a stage, he could tear it down every time. And I respect that. That is, the kids ain't got that today. What I also love, though, is that he had friends from high school and middle school that rocked with him and were there in the hospital on the last day. Like, I do appreciate that that those friends stay with him. Like, I love that. Like, at the Grammys, him, Rob, and that other guy, they in the hospital room, they're in high school. Like, that was really beautiful to watch.
Yeah. Like, to your point, Diarra, Luther, he belongs in kind of a stratosphere that to me reminds me of, like, Billy Strayhorn. And when I think about a lot of the maybe like bigger, even like when it comes to writing Billy Strayhorn, when I think about the way that he has positioned himself, and I think about Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra, he really took that and but Aretha Franklin did, and but he was just like that crooner, but he just had like a bigger voice and a voice that's that was baked inside of the church, and it had just this elasticity. It's 9 a.m. His voice was like rubber, okay? And it was able to stretch to different places. And I think that was really, it's just amazing to look at. But you know me, very critical of all Black American exceptionalism propaganda. And it is something about the fact that we have so many stories around Black people who have been blessed with Black gifts and Black genius, who pursue this this pinnacle of fame and celebrity and money and power because, you know, we are living in a society that says, you know, if it's homeless, your fault. So of course you're going to exploit your gift in order to in order to make it, so whatever. But everybody who chooses that path seems to have such miserable lives. And part of me is happy that we're at the phase of culture eating itself, where culture where I think the incentive to participate in that is just lessening. And that kind of makes me happy because there's so many people who have sacrificed their sanity and their lives. When we think about Whitney, when we think about Michael, I mean, it's just like so many people to list. And to me, Luther is in that because of being closeted, because of the ways that being closeted, not being able to be yourself and manifesting the other different ways and that relationship manifesting bad relationships with food. Like all those things are interconnected as a queer person with with who has diet and body, all those issues. Those things are just so intimately connected. And the last thing I'll say is it's also interesting speaking of culture, you know, American culture kind of being at this phase of eating itself. It's just that 70s, 80s thing never happening again. You have a slew of people who were so influenced by jazz, by so if you weren't directly influenced by jazz, you were influenced by other people. So he was a Diana Ross queen. So, but Diana Ross is a Billie Holiday queen, you know, and then you Aretha Franklin, but Aretha Franklin is a Diana Washington queen. And there is such a, in jazz, there's such a big thing around experimentation, but also excellence. So not only do you need to be able to listen to everything that's going on around you as a vocalist and as a musician and create something new on the spot, but it also needs to be excellent because we're also outdoing these white boys. And that tension, you know, I gotta rock my hips faster, move my feet faster, so I gotta be James Brown. Like that tension really birthed some crazy talent. You know, and we're just not there anymore. And I think for good reasons we're not there anymore, because I can see a Samara Joy maybe having a happier career, even if she never becomes the pinnacle of the universe like Aretha was at one point. But it also makes me think about, damn, Luther and Anita, like even the people he's beefing with, like he's like, oh, he's being mean to En Vogue, and I'm like, damn, because En Vogue is hot too. Like, you know, it's just now it's you know, we're just in a different era, in a different moment, and that pressure cooker of jazz and respectability and scrutiny really birthed some miraculous music, even if the price were people's souls and sanities and their real private interior lives that make any of that even worth living in the first place. Mm-hmm. So those are my kind of mixed feelings on it, but I love big Luther. I love small Luther.
I love all the Luthers.
I love all of Luther. And I hope Luther is in heaven loving all of himself.
Well, and the other thing, the last thing I'll say on this
is crazy.
Is, and Dre, this is for you too, is that there really wasn't a theatrical release of this documentary. And I think it's interesting with like the DEI stuff and the Donald Trump and all this, like what's going to happen to content over the next 4 years and the things that will be made and not be made and given theatrical releases and not. Like, it's wild that this did not have a theatrical release. And it's also wild that it's, like, on CNN.
But we're also in an era where we can take back theatrical releases. Like, we can, like, nobody gives us anything anymore.
We have
enough people with enough money where that can happen. And I hope that this gap actually makes it happen, because certain things are just so, certain companies are just so corny, and you can feel the, like, the old on them. I'm like, this is a
Jamie Foxx's production company. I was like, that's why he was in it. But, you know, I had to watch it on YouTube TV. I had to, like,
Yeah, but the distributor is usually, it gets bought, and then the distributor is who does the release, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not the producers just get it made.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy and the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy and the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy and the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.